everyone. I'm really super excited to talk to Rishi Dastidar. He's a poet. He's got two books published, Ticker Tape and Saffron Jack. He chairs Spread the Word. He's also edited a book on poetry craft. So Rishi, welcome.
Hey, Ben. Lovely to be with you this afternoon.
Great. So poets always have another job, it seems. I think you've talked about this. It's poets slash something else. Like, is this a good thing? Should we have like more just poets and jobs, or does the richness of life make you a better poet?
Start on the basis that there is no way that anyone can make a living from just selling their poems. So there is a necessary need for anyone who calls themselves a poet to have alternative forms of income. Now, if you're fortunate, hopefully that secondary source of income can be quite closely poetry adjacent. So teaching in a university, teaching in a school, performing your poetry on stage, on screen, possibly even, and maybe even perhaps lending some of your poetry and your voice to adverts, for example. And that's a fairly accepted and common way of being for lots of people who practice and work as poets now as well. My contention is that as an art form, though, I think it is something and such that it would benefit, there is a benefit to be had from more poets getting that secondary or getting that income from things that aren't necessarily poetry adjacent. So, I jokingly suggest / civil servant. I jokingly, not even jokingly, suggest, roofing, nursing. I happen to work as a copywriter in advertising and branding. It's slightly more adjacent than others. But I think it's notable, and I think a lot of notable poets have brought those other working lives into what they write and how they write as well. And so, I think the model of just being a poet who's largely in the academy is only just one model, and we should have more models of doing poems.
Should there be more corporate managers, in fact?
This is partly for me, because I would quite like to have the title Chief Poetry Officer. So to any viewers of this who are in a position to hire, please do consider me for said role, and I will bring magic to all your corporate communications of varying and different hues. But more broadly, I think if you think of poetry as a way of thinking, and a way of thinking that is, a slightly different from one you might get when you're thinking about creative writing more generally, I think bringing more and different modes of creative thinking into corporate life, into business life more generally, is a useful thing, partly for giving you different tools and different modes of thinking to get to different results, but also at some fundamental level, acknowledging that business, is never just rational. There is emotion in it. And it's interesting when you dig beneath a lot of what passes for commentary and talk on culture building, for example. A lot of the thread there is, these things called emotions. How do we manage those away? How do we channel them productively? That's a very corporate thing to do, isn't it? As opposed to maybe acknowledging them more and actually thinking, how do we actually recognize and use them in ways that might not necessarily be seen as just pushing them out from this domain as fast as possible? And art in its broader sense is useful for that. And I would say poetry is one of those skills and toolboxes that you can actually bring to think about that and start to do that.
Yeah, so I mean, extending that, I've read some stuff about some poets being afraid of these Insta poets. Like, I'm not afraid of the Insta poets. Are you afraid of the Insta poets? Are there, in fact, even TikTok poets? I should have looked this up. I'm assuming there probably must be by now. But should we be afraid of the Insta poets?
Oh no, not at all, not at all. So this is a semi-recurrent thing that happens maybe every 18 months or so, where somebody rediscovers Insta poetry and decides that it is a terrible thing, or at least a dangerous thing, because it, you know, it's stuff that doesn't necessarily look like what they believe poetry should be, and it has the temerity to be popular, and it has the temerity to then cross over and sell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, heaven forfend. Now, yeah, my take on it is that Insta poetry is perfectly valid as a type of poetry. You know, I mean, it's slightly odd just even still calling it Insta poetry, because after all, you know, the corollary of that would be, well, okay, no, I prefer book poetry. Who says that? No one says that. More substantively, though, a lot of people's critique of Insta poetry is positioned as an aesthetic critique. Yeah, this is rubbish, this is doggerel, this is shit. But actually what's encoded within that is actually something that's closer to an elitist critique. Because when you actually look at who is writing Insta poetry, and of course who has become successful and popular through Insta poetry as well, more often than not tends to be writers, voices of colour from marginalised backgrounds who bypass the more traditional editorial gatekeeping channels to find an audience with their aesthetic, with their poetry, which has happened to be popular. And so, yeah, so it might not be to your taste. That's absolutely fine with me, but please do not think that Insta poetry is the harbinger of the decline of civilization, because it really, really isn't. I always hope that people discover poems, you know, poetry that they like through Insta poetry, but then they discover that there is a world beyond that. Yeah, if you like Rupi Kaur, then hopefully you go on and discover, you know, other writers away, who are away from her, different from her as well. Insta poetry as a gateway drug. Yeah, I like that.
So actually, that leads me on to: do you think poetry, British poetry, or indeed global poetry, then has this challenge of a diversity of voices, and what should we be doing?
That's a big question to start to unpack. Let's start with the global. I think simply because what is very clear is that those of us in the Anglophone world, we bluntly do not read enough poetry outside of the British American tradition, because we do not read enough poetry in translation. But that's frankly part of the wider problem, that we don't read enough literature in translation, full stop. And so you know that there are tremendous poets working in languages other than English that never reach the readership, even amongst poets, that they deserve, just simply because they haven't yet been translated into English, you know, and the barriers and the bottlenecks that there are to do that. So there's, but absolutely, you know, my writing of poetry has got better by attempting to read more poets outside of English in translation, and also tentatively trying translation as well, you know, because that is a very, very good discipline to actually discover more work and discover more artists. So, you know, yes, absolutely, there is a whole sea of poets out there who, you know, one is not familiar with. In a specific UK context, there has been, I think, up until about 10, 15 years ago, there had been a big lacuna, which was that poets of colour, writers of colour, had effectively been overlooked in telling the story of poetry in the British Isles. That basically writers of colour had not even been written out, just not been considered. And so, yeah, that has changed. That is changing. And we're starting to see the fruits of a lot of work by writers and activists before, in pushing people forward, in developing and bringing more voices to readers. You know, Roger Robinson winning the T.S. Eliot Prize last year, Malaika Booker winning the Forward for last year as well for her best single poem. But that's, you know, beneath, you know, that's the tip of what has been a 2025 year project to actually start to say to the wider British poetry establishment, there is a whole thriving set of poetries and poetics that are out there that you are not yet fully recognizing. And that is, you know, and that is changing. There is still plenty of work to be done, but it is getting there and getting better. And yeah, you know, I think bluntly, credible, you know, you cannot tell a credible story about British history, about the history of British poetry now, without recognizing that large scene that that writers of colour have provided since the 1950s and 60s onwards, especially.
Yeah, I think I agree with all of that. I was really, it's quite a while back now, but I remember first discovering ghazals and Sufi poetry, and you know, this tradition which stretches back so far, has a performance element to it, followed by, you know, millions of people, right? But outside of the English language, or, you know, visual poetry. You can't look at any of those original haikus or written in Chinese or Japanese poetry and not say, well, wasn't that visual poetry before we in the Anglophone world would have even thought about visual poetry? So
precisely.
I think that's on global and obviously the British poetry true. So I guess you could argue poetry is one of humankind's oldest art forms, and considering oral poetry, there's an argument that maybe it's its oldest art form, and maybe you've had some version of the Insta poet every 2 years ever since the start of that. But there are some arguments today, I guess, that it's one of the smallest art forms, that at least in its elite form has this niche readership. I mean, what do you make of that? Or maybe the converse is perhaps if you consider rap as poetry, that there is not that. And I was reading one opinion that argued that the advent of rap and hip hop, and to some extent those forms of art, was a reaction of black artists or artists of color finding essentially a poetry expression, but in a different form. So I'd be interested to seeing, like, do you think it's one of the oldest art forms? Is poetry really small today, or is it perhaps it's more diffuse if you think about it in terms of a large art form?
Yes, I tend towards the latter. And again, you know, I think it, to some degree, you know, that question comes out of effectively a post-hyphen modern inheritance, in the sense that what you see from the 1920s onwards is effectively poetry becoming more and more elite than it had been up until that moment. And this is not to deny the power of the art that comes out from that period of post-First World War onwards. But there is absolutely an inflection point that you can detect, that where, you know, I date it even further back than the beginning of hip-hop, actually, to the moment at which, you know, pop music, rock and roll, moves out of the music hall and moves into something that's much more, that looks much more like wider society. And there's an absolute crossover point, so certainly in British poetry, where you have that happening, and you have the rise of the movement, so the last obviously white male movement of British poets, and gradually you see pop music almost taking that space that poetry once had, and you see poetry running more to the academy, running more to to art school thinking, art school theories. And meanwhile, people's hunger and desire for music and speech as song is being satisfied through pop music as well. So poetry in its broader sense is still there, it's present, it's around, it's, you know, it is as diffuse as an absolutely brilliant word to actually describe it, because we know it's there in songs, we know it's there in adverts around us, we know it's in, you know, it's in hip-hop and rap. But the elite pursuit that we call poetry, yes, by definition has got a lot smaller. But I think one of the things that isn't often commented upon is that it now is not more in terms of thinking, in terms of attitudes, with what you might describe effectively modernist, postmodernist visual arts movement and visual arts thinking. And of course, that's where a lot of critical attention and cultural, elite cultural formation attention is paid. And so you have this weird dichotomy where you have people who, you know, call this thing called poetry, and because it's practiced practiced by very few people. They give off the impression that, of course, it's a very elite pursuit, but then you actually stop and think about it, no, poetry is a lot wider, and it's a lot bigger, and there's a lot more of it around.
Yeah, great. I think I agree with all of that as well. So I like lists. You like lists. Saffron Jack essentially starts with lists and continues with lists. What's up with lists? Should be interested in them? Are list poetry? Why do you like lists so much?
Are list poetry? Yes, I mean list poems. Not quite a genre of poetry in their own right, but do they exist as a thing that's recognisable? Yes. Do I write a lot of them as well? Yes. As a sidebar, a review does stick in my mind of my first book, where it did said it's hard to I paraphrase, but yeah, it's hard to shake the feeling that this poem. Like, yeah, fair enough. can't really disagree with that. Lists are wonderfully powerful because they are orderly. They are a tool of making sense of the world. They are the ultimate weapon if you are a control freak who feels that they are out of control. Just by the very act of putting something down in some sort of order, you are suddenly making a claim against chaos. You're suddenly making a claim towards, against entropy almost, in terms of I for this moment can corral this moment in time and actually grasp things and put them together in a way that starts to approximate sense, approximate logic, approximate flow. And so I think that's why they have their appeal more than anything else. And especially in times and in situations where you feel on the edge of chaos and you feel things spiraling out of control, there's nothing more powerful than reasserting that control through doing that. If you think at a fundamental level, what the poets do, we're observers as much as we're anything else. And so, poems are bluntly lists of images, lists of sensations, lists of memories that we have refound, recontextualized, reasserted. And some of us are better than others at fundamentally disguising that they are lists. I am particularly bad at not disguising them.
So Saffron Jack is a long-form poem. Some of humanity's greatest artworks have been long-form poems. But I think arguably today, the long-form poems have gone. Yours sort of excluded. There's very few of them. Where have they all gone? Should we be bringing them back?
They haven't gone. What has happened is that a publishing industry prefers to call them something else because they might be more saleable in different ways. I could point you towards Robin Robertson's Booker Prize nominated novel, The Long Take. It's written in verse. It doesn't necessarily
have... It's a pretend novel. It's not a novel. It's a long form poem.
It looks like... Exactly. It doesn't have anything that you might recognise as traditional prose characterisation. It doesn't do much by way of plot. And when you look at the way that it's arranged on the page, lots of white space between lines. Why is it called a novel? And Robin, this is not to denigrate Robin Robertson at all. Robin Robertson is one of our great poets and editors. Presumably someone somewhere had an had a commercial discussion around, if we position this as a novel, we're far more likely to have success than
there's
we are.
There's a bigger market for novels.
Is bluntly the case. I mean, sort of knowing your field of theatre and playwright, look at lots of interesting monologues that are positioned as monologues, but then when you actually break them down and look at what they're doing on the page, they're poems as well, and they flow through and they achieve poetic effects as well, but just because they happen to be delivered by one person standing on a stage and they've been published by a Methuen or a Nick Hearn, we call them a play, we call them a monologue instead of a poem, you know. Yeah. I mean, again, this comes back to the idea of poetry being diffuse, and its very diffuseness means it's harder to actually see where it is actually a poem in disguise as something that's more commercially palatable.
It's become like one of those symbiotic creatures which has just squirreled its way in all sorts of other art forms to order its survival, because you don't name it, but it's still there. Speaking about Saffronjack, long form poem ideas, do you think there was just one major idea flowing through Saffronjack? Was that how you kind of thought about it or came about? Or is it kind of a lot of mini ideas which kind of coalesced? Talk me through how you're kind of thinking about the themes and what Saffronjack's about.
Definitely the former. The poem is an attempt to try and answer the question, what would it be like to set up your own country, call yourself king of your own country? And I know that betrays a lot of megalomania on my part, but for a long time I've been fascinated by these things called micronations. So places like Sealand, you know, even San Marino, these places which look too small to be viable countries, and yet they call themselves countries. And when you look at micronations in particular, there's always something interesting going on in terms of why someone has decided that they no longer be British or American or Australian, but they can't move to it or emigrate to a different country. So instead they decide that they must set up their own principality. And do so in a backyard, or, you know, in Sealand's case, in this Martello Tower, in the sort of person who finds themselves feeling their atoms being rearranged just by the pattern of words on a page, by the sound of words hitting the air, chances are you're going to like poetry, and you will find poets, types of poetry that work for you. And I am absolutely a hype man for poetry. I don't care whether what turns you on is the absolute avant-garde language games of J.H. Prynne, or whether it is, you know, Ruby Kaur and other Insta poets. Yeah, I am just happy that you are now in the world of poetry, and enjoy it enough, you will start to find lots of other people who have that similar, yeah, atom rendering, atom changing effect on you. If you're moved enough by that experience to start to want to produce it and create it yourself, fundamental thing you must do is read. And you will find that the more you read, the better you get at writing poetry. Because it's only by reading that you actually discover what you like, what you don't like, what is possible on a page, what isn't possible on a page. And something that people who are just setting out often say is, but if I read too much, then I'm going to end up sounding like those poets. And that's a necessary stage of any artistic evolution. You know, any writer who's published goes through a phase of sounding like their heroes, sounding like their idols. The trick is you have to push through that phase to actually start to get to a place where you start to sound like you, and you start to sound like your voice, your obsessions, the things that are really animating you. And that can be a long process, absolutely. My friend Joe Bell talks about the fact that, you know, becoming a poet takes something like 10 years, you know, of reading and writing and dedicating yourself to it, and knowing what we talked about at the top in terms of the lack of rewards, yeah, and that need for having an income outside of poetry, means that it's a vocation, and it's something that you have to really want to do outside of thinking I'm going to write a bestseller, because chances are you're not. Yeah, and so that tends to winnow people out a bit. That tends to leave the people who are obsessive stroke dedicated. But yeah, honest to goodness, don't be scared. Don't be scared of coming into this world. Don't think that poetry isn't a thing for you. Don't think that you're going to be asked, yes, but what is the subtext? of what you are saying, of what you are writing every time, because, you know, that's only a question of concern to, you know, people teaching English. Poets don't ask you about subtext. Poets don't care.
Yeah. And even established poets, writers, we all worry, like, do we really have a voice? Does this sound like X or Y? It just, I mean, in some ways, these are kind of concerns which never go away if you're a reader and a writer.
Exactly so.
And any newsletters, pamphlets or magazines that maybe people want to get into, we should look at? In fact, so I hadn't even prepared this. Look, I have one. I don't know if this is coming on screen now. This is actually sitting. I have a work desk. I have a I have a business day job. But keep poetry around for me, because you never know when that exactly. might help. So obviously that's what I would recommend. But and obviously you're linked with them, so that's a that's a bit of a biased one. So if there's any other, so Rialto, we'll put that in the links. Actually, we'll have some links in this post.
So there's plenty of places that you can go to start to discover the world of poetry. I mean, the Poetry Society is the most obvious sort of initial starting point. It is the UK's dedicated member organisation for poetry, for the promotion of poetry as well. They publish the Poetry Review, the UK's leading journal. And so taking a subscription out to that gives you an immediate sense of what is going on now in contemporary British poetry. Then also gives you a sense of the spread of activities and aesthetics that people are interested in. Poetry Society also help organize a whole raft of writing groups around the country, so if you want to become more active, that is absolutely a place to go. Hopefully reopening soon I should say, is the National Poetry Library at the South Bank, and it is the UK's main library for poetry. And you'll be able to get from there most collections that have been published since 1950 onwards, and all the latest editions of the magazines. And for those of you outside of London, Leeds has a very good poetry library in the university. Manchester, I think its poetry library is about to open soon as well, so those are well worth checking out. If you're moved enough to actually want to start writing, then do check out the Poetry School, the UK's main provider of poetry education. Plenty of courses at all levels, beginner, intermediate, advanced, taught by poets, and many poets, I should say, who are writing now, they got their starts by doing Poetry School courses. I was one. I spent a lot of my formative years writing, doing as many Poetry School courses as I could get my hands on while I was I am still learning, but while I was doing that. The Rialto as well is I am biased because I'm a contributing editor there, but it's a very three times a year we give you a very good sense of what's going on in terms of British and international contemporary poetry. So plenty to choose from there. And of course, like we've been saying all the way through, in terms of poetry's diffuseness, you will hear poetry on Radio 4. Poetry Please is a great vehicle for finding stuff out. Daljit Nagra on Radio 4 Extra has a regular slot where he digs into the BBC's archives and brings us more poetry and bits and pieces like that as well. And of course, social media. Like we said at the top, you will find poetry on Instapoems poetry on Instagram. Go there, look at that. There's plenty of poetry on Twitter as well. Go there, have a look there. Plenty going on.
Yeah, great. Yeah, Twitter poetry is a great happenstance thing I found. So this turned out to be one of the themes of our chat, is the fact that poetry is much more alive in the world and in our lives than we might think. But I had a question here about what we thought the social function of poetry is. So that kind of brings it all together. That, do you think it has a social function?
Yes.
I guess we're going to be arguing yes, but I'd be interested to see what you think it is. What does poetry do for us?
So, and I think it's something that people have been coming back to more, especially over the last 10 to 15 years, as it's felt that more of our working lives and professional lives have started to get more regimented and more, you know, and more prescribed and more broken up. And most of us, especially working in white collar jobs, are in a world of targets and fairly abstracted, dry, bloodless language. Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that there's all of that going on. People are hankering for something that is a lot wilder and a lot more untrammeled and a lot freer of those sorts of constraints. So I think there's that. I think the wider social role of poetry as a space to actually say things which it is hard to say in prose, to acknowledge vulnerability, to acknowledge pain, to actually articulate emotions, memories, sensations, which if you put them in prose would be so harrowing and so bleak that people wouldn't want to engage with them. But by making them poems, people can come in at the side and start to engage almost in a more safe way as well, and so start to open up those things. So, you know, poetry as a form of witness, I think, is absolutely vital. Poetry as a way for overlooked, overheard, unheard voices from unheard communities, is another thing as well. Claiming space that might not otherwise be achieved through more rational means of persuasion. I think there are all those functions that are there as well. I mean, not to recycle, Shelley's legislator's line, but poets have a role in terms of dreaming of what future scenarios, future states might be. Oh, and pointing to, suggesting the weird gaps and abstractions in language. The gap between rhetoric and the truth on the ground. Most good poets that you ever meet are acutely interested and are acute to those wild gaps between what a corporation claims and what they actually do, what a politician claims and what a and what they actually do there as well. Almost poets as canaries in language is coal.
Yeah, I think that's a very coherent argument for the vitality of poetry and its function today. Kind of never more important and maybe never more alive. I hadn't quite thought about it like that. For sure. Great. So
add one more point? I was just going to add one more point to that as well, in that, if you think about the internet being such a text-driven medium, you think, hypertext markup language is what it is. And, we read so many web pages. Twitter is a text-driven medium as much as it is anything else. It is therefore unsurprising that the oldest form of putting words together, which is poetry, suddenly has a renaissance as well. We're living in a much more language-driven age, so the oldest form of putting language together having a renaissance. Think those are absolutely connected.
Instagram tried to get in there with their visuals, but actually visual poets got over all over that as well. And actually audio, because even in the audio thing, you've got this Clubhouse and all of that. Going back even further, all the oral poetry and all the rhetoric and stuff. So yeah, poetry, the original social media. So coming to our last, couple of questions here. One, I'm going to put on one of your other hats, which is your copywriting hat, and how that links. So I didn't really know there was such a thing as brand language. So I'm interested in that. And I didn't know that there were grammar memes either. And I didn't know that verbs should be a superpower. So I don't know whether you want to comment on grammar memes, brand language, verbs as a superpower, and what the world of copywriting has to say about the world.
Oh, right. So I have lots of views on lots of those. The grammar memes, I think, is probably... let's recast it this way. When you look at any average day on Twitter and you look at a lot of the memes flying around, how do they actually work? Why do they actually work? It's because they're fucking around with syntax, to put it crudely. They're doing something interesting with syntax that just jolts you out of your comfortable reading. And so that's the property that suddenly makes them memeified. So that's, yeah.
Tiny bit of poetry.
Exactly, exactly. It's a poetic effect. Brand language. I think commercially in corporate land, we're very familiar with the idea that a logo, a visual identity, is something that all organisations should have as a means of carving out some sort of unique distinction, unique visual distinction. Brand language is an attempt to do that verbally for the language that an organisation might use in written communications and in spoken communications as well. Now, is it a lot harder to carve something out that is unique and distinctive through language? Yes. But at the same time, I can say to you, for example, if I said, if I sent you an email and said, "Howdy, Ben, this is John Lewis, Paramus," you would know instantly, hang on, that's not right. That's not how John Lewis speaks. You, as it's John Lewis, you would expect them to say, "Dear Mr. Yo, hello, how are you?" Da, 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 da. And that's all brand language is. It's finding the way, or the particular vocabulary, but also the grammatical, the grammar and syntax that actually starts to make that organization's personality come to life. And you can geek out on that sort of stuff as much as you, as much or as little as you want. But when you start to look at that world, you see those organizations with stronger, better, more creative brands have given as much thought to the words part of the communications as much as they do to the design and the art direction part of the communications as well. And this is why there is absolutely crossover between copywriting and poetry as well. I presented a documentary for Radio 4 last year, which investigated those links between advertising and copywriting and how you can find lots of poets tucked away in advertising. And again, this to bring us back, right now there's a moment where brands are using poets as a means of earned interest, as a means of actually communicating sincerity and depth. But also it points to the fact that we are, again, poetry is diffuse. If the commercial world is using poems, it's there for a reason.
We should definitely write to Nike and say, "You're the chief poetry officer. we've got one here." And verbs as a superpower, do we not pay enough attention to our verbs?
Yeah, we definitely don't pay enough attention to verbs. If you want a quick tip to improve your writing, no matter what you're writing, it's use more verbs. And I think people don't because they're doing words. And subconsciously, that means that they know that they're on the hook to actually do things rather than be abstracted away in various other verbiage. But if you're struggling, just actually, what happens when I change a verb? What happens when I use a different verb? And you'll suddenly start to see whatever it is that you're writing lift and change.
Great. Okay, and so coming to our final question, which is, I guess, what does being productive look like for Rishi? What does a good poetry writing day look like? Well, it could be a good copywriting day as well. I don't know if you mix and match the 2 days as well, but maybe if you've got a good poetry writing day, does it include running, is it food, everything? What does your very best day look like?
My very best day. I mean, I don't think I have separate copywriting and poetry days because my style as a writer is to get first drafts out very, very quickly and then continually work on them as we go. And so poems especially are things that arrive in between times and in that space between meetings, in that half hour between briefs or something like that. So it's rare that I have a special day where this is a poetry day. But a good day, a productive day, probably features a run at the beginning of the day, hopefully features a decent breakfast, and then hopefully at my desk by 9, and maybe one meeting, maybe no meetings, and relatively quiet on Slack and email, so I can just actually just muck around for a couple of hours.
Does it involve reading as well? Would you read a bit does that help the writing? There was one person I can't remember who said a good writing day actually starts with the first half of the day is reading in an ideal world.
I know that my productivity dips after lunch.
Right.
So
you've got to get it in before lunch.
After 2 o'clock is going to be reading, admin, and that sort of hopefully subconscious deeper thinking. Right, yeah, rare is the good thing for me that emerges after 2 o'clock. It does sometimes, but generally speaking, I better words in the morning.
Sure. And do you have a, when the previous place, was that your writing desk? Do you have a writing desk? Or
yes,
I kind of know that actually because I've seen it on Twitter, poems, because they will hit you anywhere, you know, little phone poems done on like whatever notes or stuff around. Is also a favorite kind of medium, but yes. I guess you'll get back to your writing desk and transcribe it if you can.
Yeah, I've written first drafts on tops of buses, I've written first drafts on tubes, I've written, I wrote most of the title poem for Ticker Tape on a journey from our front hall on a bus, on a tube, in the foyer of a cinema, in the cinema seat, and then all the way back as well. So they can arrive anyway, but at some point there has to be some sort of consolidation, and that has to happen at the desk. So even if the act of creation isn't happening at the desk, the act of moving into production, that has to happen there, definitely.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much for this conversation. I learned a lot and made me quite thoughtful about poetry in the world today. Please do check out Rishi's books, which we'll have links to. And if you're interested in finding out about poetry, I think our theme was just do it. Please do it.
Absolutely. Great. Absolutely. Thank you, Ben.
Great. Thanks.